Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. I'm back again with part two of TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Rod Steiger. The complete audio from the interview that we did together in November of 1999. Discussion that went on for over 2.5 hours, but Rod being surprisingly funny and insightful and fascinating. So much so that those 2+ hours seemed to me to fly by in half the time. Well, in the second half of our podcast, we pick things up with Rod talking about the movie Dr. Zhivago, in which Rod found himself the only American actor surrounded by some of the best in England's vast talent pool. Rod shares his memories of making that film and talks about playing Scrabble on the set with Tom Courtney and the mistake he made of getting on the wrong side of director David Lean. Rod also goes into some detail about the friendship he developed with Charlie Chaplin late in the life of the great Chaplin. Steiger and Chaplin, I mean, who knew? We also talk at length about Rod's Academy Award-winning role of Sheriff Gillespie in The Heat of the Night, and also working with director Norman Jewison on that film, and Sidney Poitier as well. We also talk about some of the real-life people Rod played during his career, like Napoleon, Al Capone, and W.C. Fields, and the challenges associated with bringing legendary figures like that to life truthfully. Rod also discusses the two great life lessons that he's learned, and why those life lessons made him want to continue working, which he did do until his death at the age of 77. All that and much, much more. So he originally recorded in November of 1999 and first shown in its abbreviated television version on TCM in April of the year 2000. Here's TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Rod Steiger.
Let's talk a little about Dr. Zhivago.
Yeah.
1965, David Lean, a big, big picture.
Yeah. Well, I was very pleased that I got in that. And when it was over, I was pleased, I don't know about my performance, but I think I proved if you give the American actor a break, he can play style as well as anybody and speak as well as anybody. I mean, I got Alice Guinness here and I got Ralph Richardson there. And so all that crap about mumbling, you said, wait a minute. You give the American actor a chance, he can speak as well as anybody. A mid-Atlantic speech, you know, instead of the phony English accent. So I was pleased because I was the only American in it. And also, I don't get a chance to play people. He was kind of a romantic figure. He was one of these people that was like evilly attractive. I remember when we were in the Navy, there was a game this buddy and I used to play. We go to a dance hall, right? And you go over and you said to the pretty girl over there, how are you, my name? You see that guy over there? Stay away from him. He's dangerous. 10 minutes later, she's dancing with him. Right. So we used to take turns. So he's a bad guy. Oh God! Sorry, ladies. But, you know. And Komarovsky kind of had that. You know, he was extremely well educated. I have in my mind his house was full of the best paintings in the world, the best wines, the best people, the best intellects, and things like that. But I was happy that I could speak as well as those fine actors did.
Did you have much interaction with him? Or?
No, my scenes more or less were with Julie Christie. But I did have a nice byproduct. I became very good friends with Tom Courtney, who's a splendid actor, you know. I remember one scene, it was not me, it was Chaplin's daughter, Geraldine Chaplin. This was her first big thing. In her first scene, she's got to read a letter to Ralph Richardson, Sir Ralph Richardson. And she was standing there reading the letter, and underneath the costume, she was, I don't know how the camera didn't see it. I felt so, She was like that, you know. Julie Christie, wonderful. They were good people. Omar, he was terrible to her. He was, I don't mean terrible in a bad way. You know, he was the captain of the Egyptian Bridge club or whatever it was, team. And so we used to play Scrabble. And Courtney and I, we got him. We got him. And then he put down the Z or the X and destroy us because he knew he could remember every card. He could remember every letter you put down.
He was a champion player.
Huh? Right?
Champion player.
Yes. Right. Oh, my God.
All over the world.
Yeah, he was one of the best players in the world of bridge. Lovely man. Most beautiful eyes God ever put in a man's head. Very well educated, very nice. And a real, in the nicest sense, a bon vivant. He loved his ladies and racehorses. He lost a lot of money. He lives in Paris and that.
David Lean is the director. How was he to work with?
Well, David, I made a big mistake with David Lean. The first night we're shooting, I got the scene where I'm in the carriage, I come around the corner, and I have to kiss the girl, Julie Christie. And what happens is I come around the corner in the sleigh, and there's the camera. The camera goes with us a little bit, and then I kiss her. She don't know I'm going to, and we drive out. We go out of the shop. And Julie didn't know it, but from the head up, she was doing fine. From the neck down, she was anticipating the kiss because she was scared of this big part for her. So we do it once, we do two, do T, and then I made my mistake. I said, Mr. Lean, could I talk to you for a minute? About what? That's how he talked. I said, I'd like to talk to you about the scene. Now, he had Robert Bull had worked on this thing 1,400 years, right? I'd like to talk. Oh, you'd like to talk about the scene, would you? I said, yes. Could I talk to you privately? Yes, of course, privately. What is it? So we go off, and I said, well, see, we'll come around the corner, then I'll kiss her. When she expects it, you stay with me. I'll put my tongue in her mouth the second time. You get what you want. Really? Yes. We shot it. One take. We got it. He never said thank you. He never forgave me. You know. He was a great director. As an actor's director, he had impeccable taste, so he hired people who could get themselves out of trouble. You know, his weakest point, I think, was if an actor got in trouble, what to do. But he hired people who were so good, all you have to say is, there's something wrong. Oh, just a minute. You know. He never forgave me for that.
But you've said some of the best directors you've worked with are people who've been actors before, like Sidney
Lumet.
Well,
Kazan and Lumet and people who have had some kind of acting experience. See, I am very serious when I say this. Directors and producers should take an acting class for at least 6 months to a year. They should do one scene at least so they know the terrors and the mysteries or whatever it is about acting. They know what they're asking for. And the ones who have been actors know. They know you have to be quiet. Give him a chance. If he wants to have time, let him take time. Movies would be 100% better. And I mean the money people, too. Just go to an acting class for a couple of months and do a scene. Get up on your feet. Then you'll understand all about the bullfighting here. You know? The fear of failure, the attempts to find a new way of answering a telephone, all this kind of stuff.
You worked with Geraldine Chaplin in Dr. Zhivago. You got to know Charlie Chaplin quite well, didn't you?
Oh, my God, yeah. I drove over the Alps in a little Cinecento, 500. And I was married to Claire Bloom then, and she had done Limelight with Mr. Chaplin. And she's going to visit Una Chaplin. So we get to the house, and we're there 10 days. And the first day, I'm a nervous wreck. You know, oh, my God. And I see this man about 9:30 in the morning, immaculate, beautiful, silver, wavy hair, beautiful jacket, trousers, moccasins, tie, immaculate. And goes back, and he goes, sits on a porch in the back of this huge house he had mansion with a flock of papers and a secretary. So, I remember, I want to go to the pool. It's on the lake by Vevey, but he's got a pool. So I am not to distract greatness, tiptoeing. And of course you can't win with a man like that. He suddenly says, for God's sakes, what are you doing? I said, I'm not going to have the. And he went, I was going, well, go to the pool. I didn't want to, you're not disturbing me. I'm adding up my communist holdings in U.S. Steel, Standard Oil, and General Motors. I will never forget. That's about how much communist he was. That's what they were doing. He was checking his investments, you know. Then one day, now what happens is it's very, you're up in a different altitude. About 9:30, everybody goes to sleep except Mr. Chaplin. And I am sitting with a genius in his front room. And the first night, I'm starting to fall asleep in presence of this genius, which is a no-no. And I'm saying, oh, of course, yes, I understand that. And I had him to myself for 10 nights. It was amazing. And he wouldn't show any of his pictures. Because I hadn't seen Monsieur Vidu. And I joke with him. I sent a telegram to his own house. And his wife, Una, said, well, you came, he alternates. All of a sudden, for 3 months in a row, every night we see a picture. All of a sudden, you don't want to see that old junk. And he's not showing it to anybody. And he says to me one night, we're going to show a film tonight. Ah, right. It's the fifth birthday of his boy. He's
That's
photographed.
The film.
And he thought something was very funny because the boy had a sword and a suit of armor, and the sword broke, and the kid didn't know what the... Isn't that funny? He said, that's funny, you know. So you never knew with him. He said to me one day, do you like... And that's how he talked. Do you like cream? So now this is about the third day I have learned to be specific with this man. And, of course, you lose. I said, what kind of cream? He says, my lord, cream. Cream for strawberries. Cream you put in coffee. Cream, thick. Lovely cream, you know, because I was going to use cream for toothpaste. We drive 30 miles one way, and he buys a half a pint of tea of cream. He was not the world's biggest spender, right? We drive 30 miles back, and I'm saying, well, get a corn. That night we're having dinner, and they bring in the grease. Look at this cream. Watch this, he said. Look, when I put the fork in it, it stands straight up. He said, that is cream. And I said, yes, sir. You know, what am I going to say? But, and then the night I got friends with him, he said, we're talking, and he starts doing Hamlet for me. And that's not his thing, because it was, you know, he's not that kind of an actor. But he's doing to be or not to be. Very old-fashioned. And I'm sitting there, and I know what's going to come. He says, what do you think of Hamlet? So I said, well, I don't think it's done in the last 100 or 20 years. I'm waiting. He said, you what? I said, well, there was a group of people, so there was a large gay community. I don't mean this detrimentally, Mr. Chaplin. They've made that kind of into their figurehead, and a lot of people who play it unconsciously twist it sometimes. I think he's much more of a masculine man of action who is defeated. It's around the room. Around the room. I said, Jesus, pack your bags, buddy. You're out of here, right? And all of a sudden he says, by God, you've got a point there. I never, and then he's not talking to you, and he goes, Charlie, what's the matter with Charles? For God's sakes, it is so obvious. Of course, you know, and he carried on. After that night, he'd say to me, Rod, my boy, and suddenly he's saying, my boy. Now, this is the other side that's very sad. When we left, Una Chaplin, rest her soul, said, he never calls his sons my boy. That's sad. And he said, well, you know, Kennedy, President Kennedy has called me 3 times to come back to the country, you know. His kind of talent. He said, you don't need the country, mister. You can make up a country. And he said, don't be ridiculous. Of course, the eyes are twinkling. You know, he liked that, you know. I said, no. Well, I never went back, he said. They embarrassed me. I said, they certainly did, yes, you know. But he was something. And I used to always tease him because we sat around this huge table with about 900 children. And he didn't know it, but he watched everything that anybody ate. And I noticed, you come from a poor family, you're checking the lamb chops, you don't know it. And when I knew he liked me, I took a chance. The butler, whoever, the woman came in with a huge plate of lamb chops. I said, Miss Chaplin, I'm going to take three now, because I might never get the chance again. Oh, for God's sakes, you can have 50 chops if you would. That'd be ridiculous, you know. He was some, and then... Years later, I'm sitting in Simpson's in London where they have the roast beef and they have the fish. And I'm upstairs on the second floor and a man comes up and said, Mrs. Chaplin, he's downstairs with Mr. Chaplin. She'd like you to come down and say hello. And I walk downstairs and there's this man like that. Looked like a rancid marshmallow. And Una says, Charles, it's Rod. I know who it is. You know who it is. I know. You don't have to tell me, Una. And I said I paid my respects. And I mumbled the conversation and I went back upstairs. And I wish I had never seen that because I remembered him, you know. I never forgot that. Also, it reaffirmed again that there's no such thing as the... chosen people or the chosen person or anybody else. Nature has no favorites, you know. That was sad.
Back to Rod Steiger, the loved one. Let's talk about that.
Well, the loved one was difficult because I didn't want to offend the gay community. What your sexual preferences are is your own business. And here I'm playing. So I tried to play him as a eunuch. And I didn't know how the hell to do it. And I was going up to see Tony Richardson, who directed the picture on this big home they were located in Hollywood for the film. And I still didn't know how, I didn't have any concept of it. And as I drove up, I passed a little statue about that high, of Bacchus, made out of concrete, pouring the jug of out of the jug wine. And I said, that's Mr. Joyboy. I come in, I said, Tony, come here. He said, what? I said, come in. We come out, I said, look at this. He said, what's that? I said, Mr. Joyboy. He said, what are you talking? Oh, my God, he says. And he had an expression. He says, super, Rod, super. And so I had my everything. I had white makeup. I had to make my hair white and curly and silver. And, you know, and I... One of the ad-libs, so he's like that, and so they just brought in a woman and a baby. He made his living painting corpses, right? And he said, well, I'll take the baby, you know. And I had a very good time, and I'm very happy to say that the homosexual friends of mine were not offended. I was worried, you know.
It's one of the few comedies you've done, too.
Well, I don't get a chance because my comedy comes from the character. Look, I just... In Crazy in Alabama, I play this southern judge, you know, and I could have fun fooling around with him because I remember there's a scene where the lawyers come up to protest Melanie Griffith's on trial for killing her husband, which she should have because he was so abusive. And they're standing there. I'm supposed to say, well, now you go back and sit down. So I said, you go sit down, and they didn't move. I said, I presume that you gentlemen have asses? And they said, yes, sir. I said, well, I want you to put your asses on the bench. Go sit down. So, and then when I did the other judge, I just finished in Hurricane Carter with Norman Jewison. I play a judge, and no fooling around there. That was, you know, for real.
Most people associate you today with two films, On the Waterfront and In the Heat of the Night. And how did In the Heat of the Night come up and come into your life?
I don't know. I guess I was doing pretty well then. I had done the pawnbroker and everything. So I guess it, from their point of view, the industry, I was a fairly good monetary investment for, especially my whole my largest following has always been in Europe and around the world. It's been nice here, but it's, you know. So I got to play it, and I remember the first day, Norma Jewison, who is a wonderful man and still the only director who can entertain you and make a social comment at the same time. No, the directors don't care about society much anymore, unless they're using it as an exposé of brutality of something, right? And he said, he chews gum. I said, oh, come on, Norm. That's the biggest cliche in the world. He said, well, try it. So it became a challenge. And I realized I could indicate his thought process. And now he's excited. Somebody says something. That stops him. Then you got the other two when he's thinking. You know. So I learned how to use it. That's the trick. You take a cliche out of being, how can you learn to use it so it fits the character, you know? So then we left it in, you know. But Norman's wonderful to work with. And Lee Grant, who's one of our best actresses who should be employed every day, she had, I think, the toughest part in the picture. She played the wife. I want you to do something. My husband's been killed. The worst cliche lines in the world. And she made it so personal, it was touching. That's hard to do because it was a cliche situation to begin with, and she just made it her own. I always remember that.
Sidney Poitier has also said that the best acting lesson he ever had was watching you and working with you in that film, how you never left your character.
Well, if I do an accent like I did in The Heat of the Night, I talk like that, I do it, would drive people crazy because I do it 24 hours a day because then I don't have to listen. I can't listen to myself. I'm back to judging a character again. I can't listen to myself, judge myself, and try to act. And it all depends. I was happy because the first thing I said, I am not going to have short hair. Every bloody policeman I've seen has short hair. I had, my hair was long. I had chukar boots. I had everything you weren't supposed to have. And the most memorable moment in that film for me that I remember today is we were going to shoot this scene inside of the sheriff's house, right? And we went to shoot, but it was an old house, had a tin roof. And it started to ring, and it hit the roof like, we couldn't shoot the sound. So we all decide we're going to go out and sit in the car until this shower passes over. And we're in the car, Norman admits it, and Sidney admits it, and I admit it. We're not very happy with this scene. And we sat in the car, and we begin to improvise. And we took the improvisation. This is the way a movie should be made, but you got to have the right kind of actors and director. We came back in the room, and we shot that scene where I said to him, look, boy. And he said, don't call me boy. Don't ever. And I had a problem because we had to come out even again. Because he was Wild Bill Hickok, I was Wyatt Earp. And we had an understanding that came through experience, not conversation. We learn to respect each other in spite of our colors because in action, what we did demanded respect if you were normal or sane, right? And I'm sitting there and said, look, how do I? And as he's talking to me, I said to him, wait a minute. Don't you pity me. So the pity thing, we got out of it. I don't know how, but we got out of it. Norman is, I just finished the picture with Denzel Washington and Norman about Hurricane Carter, who was unjustly put in jail for 9 years because he was black. That was the only reason when he was one of the champions of the world. And he's a delight to work with. Norman is a very close friend of mine, and it's a pleasure.
Was that a film that you had any idea that it was going to hit such a nerve or
no,
strike such a...
No, you knew the material was good. Like I said before, you had a good director, you had good people to work with, and you figure, well, this might come off all right. But as I said, I don't... When I would select a part, I don't think about... the only thing I think about when I... Well, not the only thing, but one of the things that's very important to me, if it's sick, the film or the character for no dramatic reason. I said, thank you, I don't want to. Thank you. There was no reason to slit his throat. There was no reason to beat up the woman. There was a thank you. No, not for me, you know.
You've probably played as many or more historical characters or real-life people than anybody the side of George Arliss.
Well, I like that. That's what I like best, you know. I never signed with a major studio, but if I had to, or if I, that would lure me in if I just did famous people, you know. I only had 1 year of high school, and another thing acting did, because of you have to research and you get into so many, from psychology to history to sociology and all these things, the arts. It gave me somewhat of an education, which is good for an actor. You know, I have young actors come up to me and say, you know, I want to be an actor. I say, well, who doesn't, you know? What should I do? I say, how old are you? So I'm 19. I said, join the Merchant Marine for a year. They look at me like I'm insane. I was in the Navy 4 years, 4.5 years, all World War II. And it was only later that I realized by osmosis, my accent, the Southern accent, guy aboard the ship named King, big heavy guy, and around the world, different people, different cultures, different foods. Great for an actor. And for young ladies, I say, be a volunteer. See if you can get the volunteer in an emergency room. You'll learn a lot pretty quick. And then go and try to find a good teacher in that New York and act any place you can.
One of the characters you played in a very important and big film was Napoleon in Waterloo. Tell a little about that, studying for Napoleon.
Well, that was a disappointment to me.
The end result or playing it?
The end result, because Dino De Laurentiis, the producer, Italian producer, unfortunately went to Cinecittà, which is the name of the film school in Rome, and he decided he was going to edit the English version. And I had written 3 or 4 scenes for that picture, and I had worked very hard. You'll notice at no time do I ever put my hand in there. Just put, not even for publicity. I said, why? I said, because I make it a caricature. I'm not going to do that. And I was glad when I was at Malmaison, wherever where they had an exhibit, there was his glasses. Because when you play a picture, a person that large, you got to find something the populace can identify with. You know, so he has to put on glasses to read this. Oh, he's human too. Okay, you know. And it really was interesting. I think one of the most interesting that happened, we're out in the middle. I come to work. We're about near Lwów, which is very near Czechoslovakia and that. And there's 12,000 actual troops, 5,000 actual cavalry, all from the Russians. All they did was change their real uniforms and put on the period uniforms. And I come out and Sergei Bundarchuk, the Russian director, says, Drodno, you go home. And of course, I've done a few films by that time. And the first thing you do when somebody says that is check the sun and the weather. It was a beautiful day to photograph. And I said, no, you wouldn't understand. Go home. We have Moscow, says big wind coming. We have to tie down everything. So I go back to this terrible hotel I'm sitting in. 3 days go by. There's no wind. There's no nothing. And I found out that the troops on our picture changed into their own uniforms and went into Czechoslovakia to help settle an uprising. So I used to tease him terribly. I used to say, is there any wind today? You know? But I was upset because I did, there was a scene, La Bédouillère was his favorite lieutenant. It was played by a young, very good-looking guy. And I had written a scene where he sees Napoleon writing a letter. He says, sir, why? What are you writing? I said, I'm writing to the Pope. Now, you're talking about one of the biggest agnostics in the world. He said, you're writing, I don't understand. He said, sit down. The kid sits down and he says to him, you see, and this I learned from some of the diaries of Julius Caesar and some of the other. He said, you see, you conquer a nation with an army but you sustain it with a religion. You never attacked the religion of the people you conquer. You know, so I had nice things like the last scene. I wanted to make sure I brought him down to earth. The carriage is going through the rain. In the scene I worked up, he gets out of it. He goes down, goes behind a tree to go to the bathroom, which is making him as human as I can make him. He comes out and he said, "La Badia, what day is it?" Now, here's a man who's just lost the biggest battle of his life, lost everything. And the only way I could identify with it, once I, it shows you how everything works with it. Now, I fought three rounds in for my ship in the Navy. I thought I'd quit. I wanted to quit in the middle of the first round, but you couldn't do it because people. So I could understand that kind of exhaustion, you know. And La Badia says April 12th. Oh, April 12th. April 12th. All of a sudden, out of left field, he's La Boer. "I want my son. I want my son." He adored his son, and the princess, he never let him see it. And then everybody looks, and they help him back in the carriage. So he edits it. The carriage stops. I go behind the tree. I say, I don't know. Anyway, nothing. I get back in the carriage. I could kill him. That was a lovely scene.
So it was all cut.
Yeah. Well, I do that a lot, but it comes to improvising, you know. I remember with Faye Spain in Al Capone. She played Al Capone's girlfriend. And in the script, she says, "Did you kill my husband?" And then the Duke, "Yes, I did." He would never say that. He was too smart to say that, especially he really loved it. So I said, "Get us a tape recorder. Let Faye and I be in a room. Just leave us alone." And I said, "Faye, do me a favor. No matter what, you just ask me, did you kill my husband? Did you kill my..." And I'd say, "Don't be ridiculous, of course." "Oh, come on. Stop it, sweetheart. I wouldn't go near you. What are you..." "Yes, I did!" His temper. His personality. He's, "Yes, I did." Mm-hmm. But it's too late. That I could believe. You know. So that's how I work, you know, things like that.
W.C. Fields, another great character you played. Were you happier with that?
Not really, because the script could have been a lot better, I think. But I was happy. I was scared to death because everybody in the world insists they can do W.C. Fields. Sex is not important. They'll do W.C. They're the elevator up. "Ah, yes, nice day today," you know. And one of the highest compliments I ever got, I had a scene in the picture. He had two voices, I said. One is, like it was being interviewed now, I talk to you like that, you know. I had a lot of trouble. I one time was the world's greatest juggler. And that took a lot of practice. Cut my fingers to ribbons. And if he was acting, he said, "One time I was the world's greatest juggler." He just let it roll, you know. And I had this small scene where I was supposed to say, "Well, gang, I want to tell you something. I like working with you guys. I like working with the crew." And that's all I had. I could go home then. And I was so happy. Somebody said, "You know who one of the extras is going to be?" I said, "No." They said, "Carlotta Monti." I said, "What are you doing? She lived with him the last 14 years of his life. She's going to look at me and say, what are you supposed to be? Who are you supposed to be? What are you doing?" In the first place, you don't tell an actor that unless after the scene, for God's sake. Don't tell him. Well, I got up and I'm waiting because he had a nickname very few people knew. Even a lot of the books I read, they didn't know it. And I said, "If she says after I finished, I like what you did for Mr. Fields, I'm 10,000 miles away. I like what you did for Bill, I'm 5. I like what you did for whatever it is." And I finished, she was crying, and she come up and she said to me, "Oh, Woody, 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 I love you, Woody." And I didn't care what the critics said. That to me. And the other high compliment I get, I did Ernest Hemingway on stage. The play didn't do very well. I'm backstage. the door opens and these two guys who look like twice the height of John Wayne come in with this little woman. And she rushes up to me and puts her arms around me and said, Ernie, you're not dead. Ernie, you're not dead. Mm-hmm. That's the two highest moments I ever had. They were really incredible.
Was there anything particularly that you wanted the audience to learn about W.C. Fields that they wouldn't know?
The loneliness. I would have been very happy if that picture, we would have had a real good picture, if that picture was just me and, what's his name, Billy the small man.
Billy Barty.
We had a great relationship going. They had to put the girl in it, and that didn't quite work. And I don't think she was that interested in the acting anyway. But
Valerie Perrine?
Huh?
Valerie Perrine?
Well, you said it, I didn't, right? Anyway, but his, and a lot of his previous, his childhood, he really exaggerated. He didn't starve that much, and he didn't live off sandwiches stolen from the bars and that much, you know. But he was something, and he became a comedian. He was in the Ziegfeld Follies, and he actually was the world's greatest juggler. And if he did the cigar boxes, like he had 30 of them finally. You know, we'd go like that. And if he dropped something, he'd say something, and the audience would laugh. In fact, the other story is he's doing his act with the pool table with the in the Ziegfeld. Nobody's laughing. They're laughing at the wrong moments. And he looks around, and underneath the table is another famous clown comedian, Ed Wynn. And Ed Wynn's under the table making faces. He took the pool cue and knocked them out. Whop! And then he went on with his skit. He was something.
Are there many films that you've turned down that you wish you'd done in retrospect?
Oh, yeah. If I don't like the part, yeah, I still do, you know, even though I had the depression. I can't remember any of them, really, but if I just...
What about Patton?
Huh?
What about Patton?
Well, I turned down Patton because, you know, first place, you got to deal with the person called the human being who's also an actor. I was doing good. I had won the Academy Award and everything. And no matter what anybody says, the better you feel, the stronger your philosophy, right? And I was feeling on top of the world, and I said, I'm not going to glorify war. What a jackass I was, man. I'm not going to do that. And so I turned it down. You know, on another day, if I needed money probably or I didn't feel good, I would have said, oh, yes, sure. And Mr. Scott, if I did half as well as he did, you know, I would have been a very happy guy.
You've said one of your favorite films is The Chosen.
Yeah, I like The Chosen. Of course, again, you see, challenge is so exciting to me. I mean, The Chosen, this Rebbe, this old rabbi. And also, I wanted to see if I could do The Chosen without any shadow of the poem book.
The Chosen is basically, tell us what it's about.
The Chosen is about this old rabbi who gradually, again, learns about life from the people around him and the relationship with the young child who's in the picture. And the first day we're going to shoot, I'm living in Brooklyn Heights. Is that it? Yeah, Brooklyn mm-hmm. Heights. And they're shooting around the corner. So what's great, I'm walking out of my kitchen, I go around the corner. First day I said, what we're shooting? They said, the dance. I said, what dance? In the script it says the dance. Now, I don't read because I get influenced, you know. And I said, oh, yes, the dance. And I'm in the so I'm sitting there, and I had some real rabbis who were on the set that are going to do the dance. And I'm going, oh, do you want to dance? Tell me something. And I got away with it, with the fur hat, the whole thing, and I'm dancing. Da-da-da. And this may sound sacrilegious. And I said, what am I doing? I said, I'm trying to seduce God by dancing. Now, that's how crazy my mind is. Said I was dancing. Ta-da. I got away with it.
Now, is it true that you and Maximilian Schell switched parts?
No.
Not?
They wanted to, no. We didn't switch. I just said, I want to, you know, who's going to play the rabbi here? What are we doing, you know?
Why is it in your 70s you're working as hard as you are? A man who likes free time?
You mean why at the age of 59 am I working so
desperately? Why at the age of 47 are you working
so? I thought I heard you say that. Yes, 59, I think. That's my life. I mean, there's only two ways to die. One is in the middle of a very exciting orgasm, and the other is in the middle of a great part. You drop dead in front of the camera. And I have found, I have two cars, and the license plate on one says Courage, and the license plate on the other says Keep Moving. And after 70 years or so, 74 years, that's what I've learned. And any feeling of youth or maintenance of an imagination, I believe, depends upon participating in life, being active. I see people who are younger than I, suddenly they say to themselves, well, I'm old, you know. And you not only be old, be dead in about 5 years, like men who retire. How many of you all of a sudden, my God, what happened here? This guy was in great shape. 5 years later, I'm at his funeral. And another thing, a lot of creative people, in a sense, to use a cliche, never grow up. I mean, it looks, they have a blessed childishness about them that keeps them. I mean, Chaplin was a young man, and he wasn't according to his age, but I'm not comparing myself to a genie, but I'm just, well, on second thought, you know. But the day you lose your curiosity, I don't care if you're 21 or 200, you died. What makes that camera work? What is this? What is that? That you need to have that. The day you lose, you know. It's very hard for anybody to get up in the morning anyway, because you don't know if you're going to make it through the day. You might be doing something you hate to do. But if you don't, they're going to bury you in the bed. And to have a cure, well, maybe today, one day at a time, 1 hour at a time, sometimes 1 minute at a time. What's happening? What does that mean? Did they shut that door? I asked the guy, when they do this, what about the pictures? That's not deliberately. Did you? Curiosity is the backbone of imagination. By that, I mean I'm curious about something. I get to know something about it. And later on, I'm doing something, and by applying my imagination, I said, yeah, I remember. There's this door that slid in it, and I try to get through it, and my foot gets caught in the door because somebody else is closing it, all right? But you don't know you're going to do that. So before I go on too much, it's curiosity feeds the imagination, and then, of course, you have to exercise the imagination. And that means you have to challenge yourself in certain instances. Am I making sense?
Absolutely.
To you? You have to challenge yourself in certain instances. But this does not, I mean, acting is not that important compared to the starving of a child or the death of somebody you love. But my message, what I'm saying here is the games I played, like when I talked to you about the department store, on a day you don't feel good, I don't care what your depression, go in and play the game. I guarantee you when you come out of that place, unless it's a funeral parlor, right, you'll feel better. You'll feel better. What does it mean to me, the woman's cosmetic? What does it mean to me, the bicycle? And you reactivate your imagination in that. I just, you know, I could have died in civil service. I was very lucky.
What about the movie business today? Should we be encouraged by it?
I don't pay. What do you mean?
Well, is it going in positive directions at all?
It never changes, really. We just have the immediacy of communication. You know, I mean, things happen faster. And cowardice begin to flourish creatively and managing-wise or marketing-wise or through the telephone. I can fire you over the telephone and then the computer. You don't know if I mean it or not. I don't see your body language. You know. Whereas if you say somebody on the computer, I don't want to get people confused. On a computer, did I get fired? And the answer comes back, of course not. Now you meet the guy and say, well, am I working or not? And the guy said, well, of course I would fire you. Don't be silly. You know you're through. So human behavior has been minimized and given to you so quickly because of mechanical inventions that we're losing a lot of contact that should be there in the important emotional moments of a person's life. Is it a boy or a girl? Am I fired or am I not fired? I'm not just talking about in general. Am I making any sense? Because mm-hmm. I can talk you to death and go nowhere. I don't know.
Any actors you particularly admire today? Young actors?
Today?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you mean to talk about Johnny Depp, is that his name?
Depp.
I don't mean the other were kind of the generation after me, Dustin Hoffman, Al Pacino. Al Pacino, I think, is a great, brave actor. He'll take chances. I like an actor who takes chances. Because if he makes it, you'll never forget it. And if he doesn't, you won't even remember, you know. But what I don't like is the economic refuge that is in television for a young actor, where he'll get trapped in a TV show, be making $10,000 a week, and remains unexploratory, unimaginative because of the lack of exploration. And he just kind of gets happy with this success that will disappear in 5 years. I have had the opportunity to see some of big television stars 2 years after they weren't on television anymore. I don't want it. The unhappiness, the alcoholism, this disgruntledness, the trying to maintain, wondering why all the sycophants left. All the rear-end kisses, where did they go? They're not on the air anymore. But that's also, in most cases, the depth of TV. Also, television is a wonder. I mean, you watch the educational programs, you watch PBS, you watch the TCM or TNT, all these programs. You know, that's a godsend if you're selective. But a lot of comfort for an actor or too much comfort can be destructive as far as his creativity is concerned and his desire to create something. I have spoke.
What's the significance?
Oh, this was a medallion was given to me by a friend. It has on it my three greatest accomplishments, my son, my daughter, and the Academy Award in 67. And this is my man, this is my leader, The Little Prince by Saint-Exupéry. I don't know if you ever read the book.
When did you first read it?
Oh, my God. I had to be about 18, about 22 years ago. No, about that. And that book, to me, is one of the most spiritually uplifting books without the dogma of any organized religion. I cannot read a book when I turn the first page and they say you're a sinner. I remember I said to my mother, I used to sleep with a Bible under my pillow, a little Bible. One morning I got up and I threw it away and my mother said, what are you doing? I said, that condemns me as a sinner. I didn't even know the alphabet when I came out of your body. I don't believe that anymore. And that's my choice. You know, I'm an agnostic. But this man, this gives you, you know, when like a... I didn't know Steve Reeves when he got that terrible accident. I said, Christopher Reeve. When he had the accident, and I sent him a copy of the book and people that I like, you know, because it's a beautiful, it sells hundreds of thousands every year in every language of the world. And I'm not plugging this. I got nothing to do with this. But it'll give you a wonderful uplift. And today it's usually in the children's department.
You're a poet. You write poems.
Well, that's my big dream. I've been writing poetry, or whatever you want to call it, since I was nine. And I think it was good. Whether the poetry's good or bad is not the important thing. The important thing for me was any of the anger or viciousness I might have gathered, or desire for revenge, or the feelings at one time I had towards my family. Instead of getting drunk, you write a bad poem. And it gets out. You don't hurt anybody, you know. And I have some people. My dream is to publish a little book of poems. You know, to be able to have somebody quote like Mr. Frost, "Miles to Go Before I Sleep," and that would be it for me. You know, that'll be. I don't know why my crazy mind. It reminded me once I was being interviewed, and a guy out of left field says to me, "What do you want on your tombstone?" And I said to him, "See you later." That son of a gun. He tried to trap me into an embarrassing thing. You know, but no, I love E.E. Cummings, one of my favorite poets. Frost, Hausman, anybody who can write "Somewhere I've Never Traveled Gladly Beyond Any Experience," I think it goes like that. "Your voice has its silence. You stand up," that's E. Cummings, or something like, when you come into the room, you know. One of my favorite lines I wrote was, "This was a man who was out to lunch forever." I don't know why, but I love that. Also, it was great. I love it. I just like poetry, yeah.
Could we have a sample of a Rod Steiger poem?
Oh, you're asking for it, huh?
Okay.
"I dreamt once, when my heart was sore, of a place, a distant shore whose trees reached towards a ceaseless blue spangled by a rainbow's hue. I stepped upon that shore and felt perfume winds enchant my mind and lent my soul to soar. I gently lowered into the pool. No, I lifted a flowered branch, and there beneath the pool, there beneath the tree was the pool I shall remember. I lowered gently into the pool, feeling it caress the unknown and the unseen in me, and my laughter shook the woods around and the surface of the pond as if it laughed with me without a sound. And suddenly there came a blow that staggered me. Reality. How bitter is that length of in-between that lies between reality and dream." I wrote that at 17. Mm. Must have been a happy occasion, right? God help me.
I'm going to ask you some isolated questions here. Do you consider yourself a character or a lead actor?
A what?
A character actor or a lead actor?
There's no such thing. Everybody, when you take, if you just say one word written for somebody on a page, you're a character actor. You're trying to create the character. I never understood the difference, you know, leading men. If I have to say something and make it my own, I'm a character actor, and anybody else is too, whether he's the leading man or what.
Okay, I'm jumping to Paul Muni now. What was it about Paul Muni's acting style that fascinated you most?
Wasn't the style so much, it was the variety. I said, that's what I want to do, create different people. That's wonderful. And then again, selfishly speaking, I've done Rudolf Hess, Andrei Vyshinsky, I've done Napoleon, I've done Mussolini, and God knows who else. And for one split millionth of a second, if you can be Napoleon, who's going to knock it? Who's not going to want to have that kind of crazy feeling standing in front of the troops? It only lasts about a millionth of a second, those times, which I call the narcotics of acting. That's what makes you want to go back again. I want to feel that unknown touch me again.
Okay, now I'm jumping to Marty. I want to establish, you did Marty on television, had a great success. Then when Heck Lancaster made the film, Ernest Borgnine got the part. How'd that make you feel?
Made me feel bad because I wanted to do it, but I couldn't do it if they're going to select my parts. And the thing I didn't like, there was a consistent rumor that my tape of the Marty Show was on the movie set when they shot it. I don't know how true that is, but I heard it so many times over the years, you know. As far as Mr. Borgnine's concerned, wonderful was, I got nothing against him personally. He has nothing to do with that.
Do you think I know that you didn't want a contract with the studio. You didn't want to be tied down and have others picking your parts. Do you think you missed out on a lot by not signing with the studio? You never regretted that?
Not at all, because if I signed, I mean, let's put it this way. How many studio productions has a part you'd want to do in 1 year? I mean, no, I have made my own triumphs and I have made my own mistakes, and that's the way I want it.
Okay, to On the Waterfront. In On the Waterfront, you played Marlon Brando's older brother, and yet you're actually a year, I believe, younger than Brando. That sort of established you as a person older than your own age. Did that help you?
Oh, I made my living more than a half of my career playing older people. I think when I did The Pawnbroker, I was in my 40s. I don't know. Things like that, on television especially. And on stage, I did... Because of my build on stage, you know, you could look older with the silver hair and all that stuff.
Okay, on the Waterfront, Kazan directed you in On the Waterfront. How did he treat you and the other actors on the set? Was he a tough
director? Oh, he's very good, because he was a good actor. He'd take a walk with somebody and they'd have a private conversation and, you know, and no, at that time, he was the best actor's director in the world, I thought. Then when he sold his friends, of course, years later, I don't know, we're talking about another person, I guess.
Okay, Al Capone. How did you prepare yourself for the role of Al Capone? You were doing a character you didn't like, essentially.
Well, what I did was, I said to myself, you have to forget you ever heard anything such as the word tough or mean or villainous. As I said before, let the audience judge what you are. I love this woman in the picture. For personal reasons, for power that he fell in love with, he came from Brooklyn. He never came, that's when somebody does Capone with an accent. No. He didn't come from Italy. He came from the Seven Points Gang in Brooklyn, and he was a bouncer in a bordello. And he died of syphilis later on because of something he contacted there. And he's a human being. I may not like him personally, but that's not my job, is to bring him alive as best as I can.
Okay, The Pawnbroker. How hard was it to put the role behind you at night when you went home? It's such a dark story.
Well, that's another thing, you know. If I do something like that's comic, like No Way to Treat a Lady or something, then I'm, when I'm on the set, one of the way it prepares, I'm talking all the time, making jokes, trying to keep myself light by the keeping the atmosphere around me light. I did The Pawnbroker, you know, they say, where is he? He's over in the corner. You know? And I didn't. The thing that helped me do The Pawnbroker was I went to a dentist, and I'm sitting in the dentist's office, and they had Life magazine, and I started to look through it like everybody else. They had complete chapters on Auschwitz and the other concentration camps with the bodies piled up. I just thought of somebody I loved close to me or whatever it was. That was it. And I used to think of those. So that was really the thing that got to the center of me, whatever that is.
But how did you handle that on a daily basis for a long period of time shooting a movie? Must have been
I don't want to be reminded of the death of my child, please. I don't want to talk. If I talk, you'll notice me. If you notice me, I'm alive again. If I'm alive again, I got responsibilities. And I should have saved my child. I should have saved my children. Even though they say it was impossible. So leave me alone. I don't want you to notice me.
So
I cut one third of my lines.
But you were basically lived that life then for the time you were making the movie.
Not really. The point is you get a little quieter. And one of the most important things in any of the arts is rest. Get enough sleep, because if you're tired, your imagination's tired. You got to have discipline, boy. You're going to get up at 5 o'clock to get to the studio and do all the makeup and everything. You got to have discipline. I don't. These people that go out and party, God bless them. They must be geniuses. I don't know how they do it. But when you're doing something that heavy, you go to bed early and you watch what you eat and everything.
Okay, I need to reestablish something here. You were nominated for your second Academy Award for The Pawnbroker,
yeah.
And one of the people you were up against was Lee Marvin in a very light, rather...
Cat Ballou.
And Cat Ballou ended up winning. How do you feel about that?
I didn't like that at all. Nobody likes to lose, right? I didn't like to know. But I got to say, when I won it with Dustin Hoffman, Spencer Tracy, and I forget who else, a bunch of very fine actors. So I felt pretty good about that, you know.
The same year you made The Pawnbroker, you made The Loved One, totally opposite kind of film, based on a very successful book. How would you describe your character of Mr. Joy Boy?
Mr. Joy Boy was a campy eunuch. He was all over the place. You know, he was, and with the silver hair and everything else. And he considered his painting of the faces of corpses equal to the Sistine Chapel, you know.
Okay. You've been criticized in some quarters that your work is too big, sometimes dominates the film too much, and that you're sometimes over the top. How do you feel about that?
I don't know. I remember early in my career I got criticized for crying. Now all of a sudden, if you cry as a man, it's okay. I don't know who the hell gave permission. I don't know. There are a lot of people who do not like emotions, who are disturbed by them. In my early part of my career, a lot of people are very uncomfortable if the male character cried. But that's not my job. My job is, you tell me something happened to one of my children, what am I going to do? Laugh? You know. I'm trying to find life in front of people, and I'm sure sometimes I went overboard, I don't know, but basically now there's much more freedom. Now all of a sudden it's okay to show the feminine side of a man or crying or now, you know. And at that time they didn't like it too much.
Okay. Following The Loved One, you played in Dr. Zhivago. How did that part come about?
I don't know. They just asked me. I was very flattered.
Had you met David Lean before?
No, I'd never met him before. You know, he and I didn't get along too well there for a while. We didn't say anything, but you could, the instinctive, there was a chasm, to say the least, you know.
About In the Heat of the Night, was there any difficulty about making a film like that on that topic right at the height of the civil rights?
We ran into, we're in Tennessee, I think it was, I'm not sure. And we're supposed to be there 4 days. And I said, when I'm going to do this film, Sidney and I were friends before the film. I want our suites to be together, and side by side, and the door open between in case anything happens. And he and I ate together and everything. We go to the restaurant, and we got into this town, and we go in the restaurant, and they didn't say anything, but they put your plate down like that and then just looked at you. And I was watching Sidney, And I could see that he was getting very upset, maybe a little bit frightened. And after the second day, he said to Norman, we got to go someplace else. My concentration's going on a lot of prejudice and private things, and I want to be able to be clear. So we left 2 days early, yeah. But the funniest thing that ever happened was I'm in a motel, and Sydney's in the next suite with the door open, and there's a knock on the door, and I open the door, and there's a 17-year-old kid with a double-barrel shotgun. I'm standing with no clothes on. He said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Steiger. I'm looking for my wife." I said, "Well," and got the tears running down and the hand to shake and we're on the trigger, right? So I said, "Well, you can look anywhere you want, you know." And he went everywhere, and I'm hoping, dear God, I hope Sidney's alone and doesn't have a lady with him, please God, and I hope he doesn't see the door. And on the way out, he said, "What the door?" I said, "That's Mr. Portier's room." I said, "Well, I got to look in there too." I said, "Well, at least let me wake him up." And I was saying, "Sidney, be alone, be alone, be alone, Sidney, be alone. Because if he sees anything, the gun's going to go first before he can find out he's wrong, this kid." And Sidney was alone. I said, "Sidney, I'll never forget Sidney." And he's standing with his boxer shorts and this kid with the shaking double-barrel shotgun. And I wonder how an actor would play that. We could talk about over the top. This kid cried for the 20 minutes he was inside our building. That's my answer to those people. He cried the entire time. An actor did that. I said, no. And then he left. And Sidney and I damn near fainted from the panic, you know. Human behaviors. For instance, I was invited by a marvelous judge, Samuel Leibowitz, who was a great criminal lawyer and then became a judge to a murder trial. I got an award, and he was one of the judges. "Did you ever see a murder trial?" I said, "No." "You want to see?" I said, "I don't know. I feel like I'm going to a man's bedroom or something." "No, come on, you're an actor." And I watched the murder trial. And number one, you're concentrating so hard on every word about 3:30 in the afternoon. It's very hard to stay awake. And I saw a man on trial for his life fall asleep. If a director came up to me and said, "Now I'd like you to fall asleep." "No, what if I'm on the trial for my life?" "What do you mean, fall asleep? What the hell kind of a director are you, right?" And I saw this guy also. Somebody told a good joke. He laughed hysterically. None of these things I had ever. That's how close to realism we really never saw in the film. You know, it was amazing to watch that experience.
Okay, you followed In the Heat of the Night with The Sergeant in 1968. Could you talk a little about your character in that?
Well, The Sergeant was a man who had been in the Army 40,000 years. He'd been in the Army. He was about to retire. He was a master sergeant. He was the Army personified in one human being in discipline and in strength, emotional control. You know, I hate that word they use today, macho, but he was the macho in the good sense. He was true. But everything was a little too much. And then he gets drunk one night, and he's out with the soldier at a dance. They get drunk. When he come back, he winds up, he kisses this soldier right on the mouth. And there's that moment they stand, and he don't know what happened. And the kid goes away. And the next day, instead of coming to the boy and saying, "Well, I don't know, I was drunk." I've seen men been drunk and do that. Means nothing. They were loaded. He couldn't go and say, "Well, I don't know what I was doing." He couldn't excuse himself, so he takes a gun, goes out, and blows his brains out. And it was way ahead of its time. Way ahead of its time.
Now, today it's not unusual for a major star to play a gay character or something, but that was very risky then.
Well, I don't think it is, you know.
Well, Tom Hanks has played it and others.
There's one point. I'm trying to think of a gay character who was as tragic or dramatic as, like, in The Sergeant or that. Most of the gay characters are too campy. They really insult homosexual people. But I don't remember seeing any American films where the leading character was dramatic and also gay.
Philadelphia with Tom Hanks would probably fall in that.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah, maybe
later. But did you ever worry about taking that chance, playing that character?
No, I don't, you know. Didn't, you know. Doesn't mean you're a bad person, you know.
Okay, shooting Waterloo in the Ukraine. Was that a great experience? Unusual experience?
Well, from a personal point of view, yeah, because I saw the Russians before the wall went down, and I saw how everything was regimented. I mean, they had a dinner in my honor in Moscow because the pawnbroker was a huge... They had written a book about me. I didn't know that. And the pawnbroker was a huge thing in Russia. Of course, they distorted it. But I couldn't get from where I was to Moscow because of the red tape. I said, but the thing is for me, I never got there. And they're throwing it in my honor. So things were not too good that way.
Such a lavish film.
Oh,
the logistics of it.
They spend, 12,000 actual troops, and they'd had their own uniforms, and they take them off and put on the Napoleon's uniform and 5,000 actual cavalry. And I had I had bad experience with horses. I'm scared of them, and they know it. And I was on, they brought this beautiful, dapple, gray, silver horse. And he was going to play Marengo, which was Napoleon's favorite horse. And I get on him, and it's supposed to be in the rain. And they're building these pipes, so when they turn them on, the rain comes. And I said through the interpreter, is this a movie horse? Da, kata show, which means good. Don't worry, don't worry. They hit his rear end with the rain, and we went, and I can't ride. I'm hanging on to the horse's neck. My sword, Napoleon's sword, goes one way. Napoleon's hat goes the other way. And thank God for the Cossacks, the cavalry. About six of them finally caught up with me and calmed him down. Oh, my God. I'll never forget that.
You met the Queen of England at the royal premiere of Waterloo. What
right.
was that experience like?
She'll never forget it either, I don't think. What they do is in the mezzanine of the theater, which is rather huge, they line up the people she's going to meet in an open-sided square. So that you start here, and she comes around till she comes to you. You're the guest of honor at the end. So. Her Majesty's car is approaching the theater. Her Majesty's car is at the theater. Her Majesty's car is stopping. Her Majesty's car, the door is being opened. Her Majesty is descending from the automobile. Her Majesty is walking across the pavement. Her Majesty is now in the lobby. Her Majesty is now walking up the steps. Her Majesty is arriving. And this little woman comes up, and she starts. Now, I had a friend of mine, a black lady, who I had brought with me because for some reason or other, I just wanted the black lady and the queen to be photographed. I don't know why. And she's coming around, and I look, and the black lady's taken off. She copped out. So I'm there, and she's with the chief of protocol. She said, Mrs. Saga, how are you? I was told, you say, Mom. I went out and rented a tuxedo from Moss Brothers. I said, yeah, I'm fine, Mom. She said, I hear it's quite a huge film. I said, yes, Mom. She said, I hear there are thousands of people, and I forget who I'm talking to. And I said, well, I don't know how to put the bloody thing together. Well, she was gone. The chief of protocol looked at me like, oh, you stupid American idiot. And he was gone. That was my experience with the Queen of England. 200 years before, I would have been in the tower, and they would have cut off my head, right?
In 1981, you made The Chosen, and that was right at the beginning of your depression coming out tenfold. How did you work through that on the film?
I don't quite remember it because you don't have a very good memory of things when at the time you were depressed. I just it was a thing you had to do. And in fact, maybe, I never thought of it this way, but trying to become somebody else might have helped me a little bit, because I had to pull away from my depression somehow, my own private problems, and deal with the Rebbe Saunders problems, you know.
One last question. What would you say to you, not that any of us have put input in, but what do you think your biggest accomplishment as an actor has been?
I'm 60% virgin and 40% whore. I have maintained a certain respect. I don't think I sold out that much. And that sums it up, 60% virgin, 40% whore. When you're a younger actor and stuff like that, you gotta do stuff you don't believe in whether you like it or not. And you gotta make a living just like a lady standing on a street corner. Don't make any difference. You gotta pay the bills and eat.
Thanks, Rod.
Thank you.